I have described Troilus and Cressida as a cynical play. The cynicism would not work, however. The irony would have no effect unless the idealism, unless the distinguished character of the material were there and stated to begin with. You have to have something for the irony to undercut. This lecture will be devoted to two characters in Troilus and Cressida, two characters who do have heroic aspirations. First Cressida, the heroine of the love story, and then Hector, who is the closest to a hero in the whole play that Shakespeare gets. The painful thing in this play, the moving thing about Troilus and Cressida, is not that a cynical manipulator like Ulysses doesn't succeed in achieving the object of his manipulations. It's that people who do try to act upon loftier motivations are defeated, and in Hector's case, destroyed. I will begin, however, with Cressida. As Neville Coghill, the English critic of Shakespeare and translator of Chaucer, pointed out long ago, the characterization of Cressida presents a strategic problem for Shakespeare or anyone else trying to write a play about her. The received story, and the story is so thoroughly received, so widely known that Shakespeare cannot make many great changes in it, the received story require that she yield to two men. After long courtship from Troilus, she establishes a relationship with him. Then she is forced to go over to the Greek side. She is exchanged in a prisoner of war exchange. Her father has already defected to the Greeks, and he demands that the Greeks get his daughter for him. And when she is in the Greek camp, she submits to the seduction of Diomedes. Now, unless Shakespeare changes the story radically, Cressida cannot be a deeply inhibited woman, or a strongly virtuous woman, or extraordinarily hard to win. Yet, she cannot be a wanton woman either. It wouldn't be worthwhile to tell the whole story if she were merely a flibbertigibbet who would sleep with any man who asked her to. She's got to be worth the winning. And this in a play where, in fact, the majority of scenes are devoted to the war. The love story plays itself out in only five or six scenes of a full-length Shakespearean play. It's scattered amongst scenes of military consultation and activity. So he has to create a woman who can be won, but who is trying to be loyal. And in that, I think Shakespeare has some success, and the success of it has been particularly underscored by recent feminist criticism of Shakespeare, particularly the work of a critic called Janet Adelman, feminist criticism that has asked particularly what are the problems that women confront in the male-dominated societies about which Shakespeare writes. Cressida's problems are clear from her opening scene. Second scene of the play, she has a long dialogue with her uncle Pandarus, who is essentially the go-between in the love affair, trying to obtain his own niece for Troilus. And she jokes and makes merry throughout the scene, continually denying that she has any particular love interest in anyone, particularly not in Troilus. Then at the end of the scene, when Pandarus has left the stage, she gets a soliloquy. A soliloquy, moreover, in verse. The whole scene has been written in prose up until this point. A verse soliloquy for a woman character is rather unusual in Shakespeare. And in this soliloquy, she confesses to the audience that she does love Troilus. And she also makes clear what her problem is. More in Troilus thousandfold I see than in the glass of Pandar's praise may be. I find more virtues in Troilus than my uncle has been talking about in his jokey way. Yet I hold off. Women are angels wooing. Things won are done. joy's soul lies in the doing. Now, that's a very compressed statement. If I may unpack it, I will say women are called angels and are treated like angels when men are wooing them. But when they have been won, then they're done. They're finished with. Men no longer pay that much attention to them. They go on to the next thing. And she generalizes that any woman who doesn't know this is going to get into trouble. That she, beloved, knows not, that knows not this, men prize the thing ungained more than it is. Men want the thing they haven't got. In fact, they overrate it. That she was never yet that never ever knew love got so sweet as when desire did sue. Therefore, this maxim, out of love I teach. I'm telling you now, ladies in the audience, this maxim, and it comes out of my love, out of being in this situation of love. Achievement is command, ungained beseech. A woman who has not yet been gained is in the position of being besought. A woman who has been achieved is under the command of men. That's the female problem in a society where the value of women depends very largely on what men think of them. So she is not going to reveal what she feels about Troilus. And if we think this is an unnecessarily harsh view of the way men treat women and think of women, all we have to do is look at the scene where Cressida finally is made to appear in the Greek camp. She is brought under safe conduct by Diomedes, and all the Greek commanders are assembled to meet her. Agamemnon, the chief commander, says, "Most dearly welcome to the Greeks, sweet lady." And he kisses her. That's Shakespeare's stage direction. Nestor is next, and very courtly counsel. I'll begin. He kisses her. Then Achilles kisses her. Then Patroclus kisses her. He kisses her on behalf of Menelaus. Menelaus isn't considered worthy of a kiss because he's a cuckold. And then Patroclus kisses her again. He takes the fifth kiss in his own right. She has been kissed five times without her saying a word about it, without her being allowed to say a word about it. So then Menelaus approaches on his own behalf, and Cressida begins to resist. She apparently thinks, you know, this is going to go on forever. I'm going to be handed from one man to another. I've got to do something about it. In kissing, she says to Menelaus, in kissing, do you render or receive? What are you doing here? Are you taking something, or are you giving me something? Do you think it's a privilege to receive your kisses? Menelaus has a decent answer, both take and give. But Cressida, her wit once going to defend her, says, I'll make my match to live. The kiss you take is better than you give. Now, you're getting more out of this relationship than I am. Therefore, she goes on, no kiss. And she goes on matching him wit for wit until he is effectively turned down. Then the wisest, the craftiest of the Greeks comes along, Ulysses, of course. And Cressida says to Cressida, may I beg a kiss of you? And Cressida says, you may. I do desire it. Then beg. That's what you asked for. And this turns out to be an even match of wits. All she's going to do is put up with the begging, and he says he's not going to take the kiss. So it's a standoff. And Diomedes leads Cressida off stage. And old Nestor says, a woman of quick sense, which is a very ambiguous line. Cressida has just demonstrated a lot of wit, and that could be what he means by quick sense. But it also could mean quick sensuality. And Ulysses, very manlike, says, fie, fie upon her. There's language in her eye, her cheek, her lip, nay, her foot speaks. Her wanton spirits look out of every joint and motive of her body. Oh, these encounterers, set them down for sluttish spoils of opportunity and daughters of the game. In other words, she's a whore. That's Ulysses' summary. And Ulysses is a wise and crafty man. But he may not see the ultimate truths. If you treat a woman like a whore, then what chance has she got but to behave like a whore to defend herself? To develop a whore's tricks, to develop a whore's wit. This scene does depict the way a woman can be used by men upon whose good opinion she depends, and the way a woman can try to defend herself. And it ends with a very odd kind of summary statement. At that moment, as soon as Ulysses has finished his summary judgment, there comes a trumpet call from off stage. Now, that's quite normal. It happens in all Shakespeare's military plays, and it simply means there is an embassy approaching or an army approaching. And the next thing you expect is for the embassy or the army to walk on stage, which they do, but not until there is another three-word line. Shakespeare writes for all to shout out, "The Trojan's trumpet." It's quite an unnecessary line. I mean, these are the Greeks on stage. There is a military call. It's obviously the Trojans coming. Did he write "the Trojans' trumpet"? Or would it sound, if all the men on stage cry out the line, more like "the Trojans' trumpet"? There is no way to tell. I think with that many voices going, some people are going to hear the Trojan's trumpet. They are going to hear 5 or 10 Greek men cry out together, "The woman's a whore," as a climax to the scene in which they have all kissed Cressida. Cressida's dilemma is quite clear in that passage. It's a very clever bit of stage direction. That's the way she's treated. That's not the way she wants to be. She hopes to be faithful. She has an heroic aspiration. It is mingled with fear and vulnerability, but in the love scene with Troilus, the one scene where they are together, which is, of course, before she's sent over to the Greek camp, she does try to behave like a lover. She is brought on stage by Pandarus, her uncle, veiled to meet Troilus. It is evening. It is clear that this is going to be a night of love. But she is shy. She is full of trepidation. She speaks only a few words. She keeps that veil on for a while. Troilus keeps talking to her. And finally, Cressid gathers up enough strength to begin to speak verbal love to Troilus. And Shakespeare marks it in his usual way. He moves from prose into verse, moves into the higher level of diction, the greater emotional expression. "Boldness comes to me now and brings me heart. Prince Troilus, I have loved you night and day for many weary months." Now, we all know how much energy, how much courage it takes to say that. "I love you. I have loved you a long time." And he asks, naturally, "Why was my Cressid then so hard to win?" "Hard to seem one," she replies. "But I was one, my lord, with the first glance that ever pardoned me. Pardon me, if I confess so much, you will play tyrant. Why have I blabbed?" Immediately the fear, the anxiety comes in there, in the middle of the statement. But she goes on. And she keeps trying to take an heroic posture about it. She takes cues from Troilus, and indeed the scene does turn into a ritual of heroism. Troilus swears that he will always be true. And he swears so in a very formal way. "When their rhymes, full of protest, of oath and big compare, want similes, truth tired with iteration, when they say, as true as steel, as plantage to the moon, as sun to day, as turtle to her mate, as iron to adamant, as earth to center, yea, after all comparisons of truth, as true as Troilus, shall crown up the verse and sanctify the numbers. It's almost like a wedding scene. These are the sacred words. This is what will make sanctified any vowel, to say as true as Troilus. And Cressid wants to make the parallel claim. All right, I'll say the same thing, only I'll say it in reverse. Prophet may you be, if I be false, or swerve a hair from truth, then let me go down, I'm paraphrasing at the moment, let me go down as the great marker of falsehood. I mean to be that true, I'm willing to take that bad reputation if I swerve at all. If I be false or swerve a hair from truth, when time is old and hath forgot itself, what a wonderful line, when time is old and hath forgot itself, yet let memory from false to false amongst false maids in love upbraid my falseness. When they've said, as false as air, as water, wind or sandy earth, as fox to lamb, as wolf to heifer's calf, yet let them say to stick the heart of falsehood, as false as Cressid. She rises to great stature there. I will take this risk. I am going to be so true that I will not swerve at all. I will let my name turn to ignominy if I dare be false. And then comes the ironic undercutting, the third person on stage, Pandarus, speaking prose. He joins this little ritual and says, if this doesn't work, if you are false to one another, let all pitiful goers between be called to the world's end by my name. Let them all be called panders, which, of course, is what we call them nowadays. A pimp is a pander. But Troilus and Cressid ignore him, and they say amen, amen, as if they were closing a formal religious ritual. She tries to hold up to that standard. When in Act 4, she is faced with separation, she goes on acting in that heroic way. I will not go, uncle. I have forgot my father. I will not join the Greeks. I know no touch of consanguinity, no kin, no love, no blood, no soul so near to me as the sweet Troilus. Oh, you gods divine, make Cressid's name the very crown of falsehood. Again, she's back to that vow she's made in the previous act. If ever she leave Troy, I'll go in and weep, tear my bright hair, scratch my praised cheeks, crack my clear voice with sobs, and break my heart with sounding Troilus. I will not go from Troy. But of course, she's not a warrior. There's nothing she can do about it. If they say she must, she can only go. And there she gets kissed by the generals. And there, a night or two later, Diomedes tries to seduce her. I have mentioned the scene of Diomedes' seduction in a very early lecture in this course. It is Shakespeare's most complex scene, and I used it as an example of how many things he can keep going on a stage simultaneously. Diomedes is trying to seduce Cressida on one side of the stage, let us say stage right. But there is a Greek embassy in the camp at the time, and Troilus is part of it, a Trojan embassy in the Greek camp, and Troilus is part of it, and he's persuaded Ulysses to lead him to wherever Cressida is being housed. And so they overlook this seduction. And there is another person on stage, old Thersites. You remember the cynic, the one who called Patroclus a male varlet, the ugliest of the Greeks, who thinks that everything is war and lechery? Well, he's over on the other side, watching all this and absolutely delighting in this fresh example of human treachery and unreliability. It's a complicated scene because there are five people there, and each of them has a different interpretation of what is going on. It is a complicated scene because it's complicated for Cressida herself. What is she to do? An unprotected woman alone in the Greek camp, receiving the advances of one of the distinguished Greek commanders. Her father has evaporated. He can't protect her. She's been kissed by all the commanders. Maybe she needs someone like this. And maybe her natural flirtatiousness plays a part in it, too, that she can't, she finds it difficult to say no. For one reason or another, she yields. It's a very complicated mindset. It's up to the actress to decide, and in part up to us, I think, how we think of her motives, why she does that. But Diomedes, of course, is just masculinely confident he can succeed with a woman, and if she's beginning to toy with him, he'll just say, oh, don't bother me, either say yes or no, be done with it, and that's it. Meanwhile, Troilus is thinking, the world is absolutely falling to pieces. Those statues that we built, the truth of Troilus, the falsehood of Cressida, and so forth, they're cracking. Our very mothers are stained with this infidelity. And Ulysses is saying in his wise old way, oh, come on, Troilus, don't take it so hard. This thing, sort of thing happens in the world. How can she stain our mothers? And Thersites is saying everything is whoredom and lechery and war and so forth. Aren't I pleased to have my theories proved? Shakespeare's most complicated scene. That's what happens to the heroic aspirations of Cressida. I must be briefer on the heroic aspirations of Hector. They are, in any case, more obvious. He is the most tragic and most sympathetic of the characters in the play. It is typical in English versions of the Troy story, by the way, to be more sympathetic to the Trojans than the Greeks. That goes way back to Chaucer and earlier, and continues even now. Hector is the great defender of the city, upon whom Troy depends. If he falls, Troy knows it is doomed. Hector, moreover, is the wisest of the Trojans. He is the only one who raises the question of whether Helen is worth all this. Brother, this is in a Trojan council scene, brother, talking to Troilus, she is not worth what she doth cost the keeping. And Troilus asks, what ought but as 'tis valued? There's nothing about intrinsic value here. If we value her highly, then she has value. And Hector says, no. Value dwells not in particular will. It holds its estimate and dignity as well wherein 'tis precious of itself as in the prizer. 'Tis mad idolatry to make the service greater than the god. Now, pay attention to reality. Is one woman, however beautiful, worth the death of all these men? We've got to pay attention to intrinsic value. He's the only person to raise the level of discussion that high. And he carries it even further to make a formal legal argument of it. If Helen, then, be wife to Sparta's king, as it is known she is, these moral laws of nature and of nations speak aloud to have her back returned. Thus to persist in doing wrong extenuates not wrong, but makes it much more heavy. Hector's opinion is this in way of truth. Then something extraordinary happens. Hector himself feels the lure of chivalry. He goes on without pause. Yet nevertheless, my sprightly brethren, I prepend to you in resolution to keep Helen still, for 'tis a cause that hath no mean dependence upon our joint and several dignities. The honor, the glory of fighting for Helen is still worth something. He is willing to give up the higher moral truth for the sake of the chivalric dignity, the glory, the honor. And that is what happens with Hector. His very chivalry proves to be his undoing. He is a great man, a warrior on the battlefield, a wise man in council, except when he yields to his second best thought instead of his first best thought. a kindly man to other people, but he is subject to those things that can undermine a chivalric hero, namely the excessive desire for honor, the desire for booty, for great prizes. In the last act, the battle sequence, he does go after a soldier who is dressed in golden armor, because it would be wonderful to have that golden armor for a prize. He falls victim to his own desire to be magnanimous. He is very much given to getting his enemy down and then sparing his life. And his brother Troilus tells him, you have a vice of mercy in you. You get them down, you kill them. This is war. This, by the way, is Troilus after he's been betrayed by Cressida. He will not say anything that harsh earlier. That's the effect of the betrayal on him. Let's kill them all. Let's be like the hurricane. You have a vice of mercy in you. Hector, take this stuff seriously. Kill them. Well, in the climactic battle scene, Hector faces off against Achilles. Achilles terribly angry because of the death of Patroclus. And they fight. Apparently they fight for some time. And then they pause. Achilles is exhausted. He's a bit out of training. He's been sulking in his tent. And Hector gives him a rest. Says, okay, breathe a while. I'll go on and do something else. He lets Achilles live. And Achilles goes and gathers his myrmidons, his own personal following of soldiers, and comes back to Achilles when comes back to Hector when Hector has taken his own armor off for his own little rest. And Hector says, hey, Achilles, wait, I mean, yeah, I'm unarmed. And Achilles says, that's all right, kill him. And Hector is killed, not in equal combat, he is gang murdered. That's what happens to you when you're chivalric. This, it seems to me, is a deeper, more tragic form of cynicism, where the man has high ideals, sees even a higher truth, but does not follow that. Nonetheless, acts on his high ideals to be a magnanimous knight, and is done in because of it. Hector is dead. There is no more to say. That's Troilus' line from the end of the play. The play should end with that mourning line. Hector is dead, there is no more to say. The implication is Troy will fall. We all know now that Troy will fall. Except that Shakespeare doesn't do that. He has Troilus deliver what could be the ending line of the play. Strike a free march to Troy, with comfort go. Hope of revenge will hide our inward woe. It's a couplet. It sounds like the end of the scene. The hope of revenge is obviously only a thin disguise pasted over the real woe. But then enter one last time the pimp, Pandarus, and begs for attention from Troilus, who dismisses him. Pandarus has no more part in his life. So Pandarus is left talking to us. Oh, traitors and bawds, how earnestly are you set to work, and how ill-requited. Why should our endeavor be so desired, and the performance so loathed? What happens to the pimps? They get despised once their service has been performed. And then he turns to us and addresses us in the audience as if we were pimps too. Good traders in the flesh, set this in your painted cloths, as many as be here of Pander's Hall, as many as you there may be amongst you of my profession in the hall of the fraternity of Panders, of pimps, brethren and sisters of the hold door trade, that stand at the door and hold it open for the customer to go in and be entertained by the whore. Some 2 months hence my will shall here be made. It should be now, but that my fear is this, some galled goose of Winchester might hiss. A goose of Winchester is a prostitute, because the brothels on the South Bank were under the jurisdiction of the Bishop of Winchester. That's why the Bishop of Winchester was quite wealthy. He got a lot of rents out of the bawdy houses. Till then, I'll sweat. Sweating was one of the treatments for syphilis. And seek about for eases, and at that time bequeath you my diseases. I am going to give you the pox. If you enjoyed this play, if you enjoyed watching these high ideals being undermined, then you're a pimp like me, you're a whore or the client of a whore, and you deserve to have the diseases I have. You may not altogether be enthusiastic about a lecture on Julius Caesar. The trouble with this play is that deep down we are convinced it is a play for kids. We all were obliged to read it in high school. This has been going on for well over 100 years. A century and a half ago, English literature was not considered a proper school subject. Boys in what the British call public schools, in what we call prep schools, spent most of their time studying Latin. Then English literature began its invasion of the curriculum. And it began with Julius Caesar and other Shakespearean plays, but particularly this one. It is, after all, classical in its subject matter. It's as close as you can come to reading something in Latin without actually doing it. It dramatizes one of the greatest events in classical history. And the language, moreover, is relatively simple and straightforward for Shakespeare. It's probably the easiest play for a modern American youngster to read. The story is clearly and strongly dramatized. The characters are very noble, and they frequently utter moral and elevating sentiments that all 14-year-olds ought to memorize. Our first contact, perhaps, for many of us, with a detailed story about ancient Rome. Caesar has been many times written of, both by historians and by creative writers, but Shakespeare has swept the field. When we are asked to contemplate the history of the late Roman Republic, most of us think straight off of the Ides of March, Caesar's assassination, Antony raising the crowd to mutiny, and Portia being the ideal noble Roman wife. We take the play as historically accurate, as a direct source of information on the events it treats, somehow transmuted into English blank verse. It came for me as something of a shock when I finally learned that Caesar is not recorded by any ancient historian as having said et tu, Brute, at the moment that he died. Those three little Latin words look so authentic sitting there in the middle of Shakespeare's text. Et tu, Brute, then fall Caesar. But that is not recorded by the ancients. Those three words put in Caesar's mouth at the time of the assassination are not written down in any source earlier than a play some 5 years earlier than Shakespeare's play, somewhere in the 1590s. It's an Elizabethan phrase. Semi-consciously, we are assuming that this is Roman reality, not Shakespearean art, and that it's Roman reality meant for teenagers to read. In fact, it was not until I encountered the essays of Maynard Mack, a great authority on Shakespeare at Yale for many years in the 20th century, that I really began to grow up about this play, to think about it in an adult way, rather than a high school way. Shakespeare wrote Julius Caesar in 1599, just after finishing his series of English history plays with Henry IV and Henry V. And just before plunging into the major tragedies with Hamlet. That place in the chronology, which we are quite certain of because we've got external sources for the dating of it, is worth noting. This play stands poised between history and tragedy. It is, of course, tragic in the thumbnail sense that I have described tragedy in a previous lecture. It depicts the fall of a great man. In fact, it depicts several falls, a series of individual tragedies in a kind of undular progression. The fall of Caesar, he dies in Act 3. The fall of Cassius and Brutus, they die in Act 5. It looks forward to the fall of Antony. We see enough of the cracks and fissures in his relationship with Octavius so that we can remember, yes, those two are going to come to wars with each other eventually, and Octavius will win and become the Emperor Augustus. Those are tragedies. But it is also history. Shakespeare is building straight out of his great project with English history, simply moving on to Rome. I should not say simply moving on to Rome, because it is a big move. Roman history was a vital subject on the Elizabethan stage. There are some 43 or 44 plays surviving from Shakespeare's time, surviving from the 60 years in which the Elizabethan drama flourished, on Roman subjects. Well, if there are 43 surviving, there were at least twice that many originally. We've lost a lot of Elizabethan plays, we know. This was a major subject about which a lot of playwrights wrote. For educated people of the European Renaissance, Rome was, in fact, the major ancient civilization, the major alternative civilization to the one that they had themselves. For us, nowadays, looking back at our European past, I think we're likely to think of Greece as being more important than Rome. The achievement of Athens in philosophy, in poetry, in art, in drama, and democracy are more important to us. But the Renaissance Europe had no democracies. Greek was for them a language only read by scholars. What was valuable to them in Greek thought had by and large been transmuted into Latin, was available if you could read Latin. As what was valuable to them in the history of ancient Israel had been transmuted into Christianity. They knew little about Egypt, less about the East, and were just beginning to find out about Africa and the Americas. Rome was the highest evolution of pre-Christian or non-Christian civilization that they knew about. And because Roman writing had survived so extensively, there never was a period in the history of Europe when people were not reading Virgil and Ovid. Those texts remained in circulation to anyone who could read Latin, and many people could. Because all this writing is around, the study of Rome became a profound activity. It was a major way to study the earthly condition of humankind, to take that whole history of Rome from its foundation back in the 8th century BC and follow it through to the fall of the Roman Empire and afterwards, 1,000 years of human experience. Before the Christian dispensation, of course, but nonetheless the human experience. All education, beyond the most basic learning your letters level, was conducted using Latin texts or Latin handbooks, anthologies based on Roman literature. The political crises in ancient Rome were considered particularly revealing moments of human history, throwing a light on human nature, light on social organization. Indeed, much ethical and social and philosophical thought in the European Renaissance took the form of commentary on ancient texts. Commentary on Virgil, on Seneca, on Cicero, on the major writers of the late Republic and the early Empire. Machiavelli's major work, The Discourses, is a commentary on the history of Livy. Educated people and even uneducated people in a mythological and fanciful way considered themselves to be direct cultural and intellectual heirs of Rome. So the matter of Rome is important. And I call this lecture the matter of Rome in the sense that, well, the tales about King Arthur were summed up as the matter of Britain. The tales about Charlemagne and Roland were the matter of France. The matter of Rome, the major stories about Rome that matter to us. This is what Shakespeare is dealing with in Julius Caesar and in Antony and Cleopatra and in Coriolanus. Now, the Elizabethan stage did not attempt to represent Rome in terms of set. It wasn't a realistic theater that built sets. They probably did some representation in terms of costume. There survives one Elizabethan drawing of a scene from Titus Andronicus, and the costuming is eclectic. It involves Elizabethan costume, some Roman costume, some timeless costume, just a flowing gown for a woman. But certainly Titus is wearing Roman armor and a Roman helmet with a plume on it. They had some sense of doing period stuff there. More importantly, Shakespeare depicts Rome by constant references to Roman things. The name of Rome happens very frequently in the text, often at the end of a blank verse line, so that it takes the stress. It has the resonance. There are references to the statues of Pompey, references to Aeneas, our great ancestor, the Trojan hero who came from Troy and first founded civilization in the Italian peninsula, references to Pompey's porch. But I think perhaps the most distinctive way in which Shakespeare represents Rome in this play is to accept customs that he thinks are particularly Roman and that are different from the customs that the Elizabethans had and that he allows to prevail in other plays. My chief example may sound odd to you, but it's a good one because it's quite thoroughgoing, and that is suicide. A willingness to commit suicide under certain circumstances, to leap into the pit rather than be ignobly pushed by others, to kill oneself rather than survive under humiliating circumstances. This was regarded as an act of high honor by many ancient Romans. Now, in Christian thought, suicide is, of course, utterly wicked. It is robbing yourself of the life that God gave you. It's up to God to decide when you're going to die, not to you. And suicide was further condemned because it was connected with the sin of despair, the worst sin of all, the sin unforgivable, the sin that means you have no faith in God, that you have no trust in God, you have no hope. In Shakespeare's plays with Christian settings, suicide is condemned. Hamlet speaks of the canon against self-slaughter that God has laid down. But in the Roman plays, suicide is praised as an act of moral courage, the rightness of which is beyond question, the nobility of which is particularly stressed. In fact, suicides tend to occur in pairs, with the suicide of a supporting character, as it were, accompanying and validating the suicide of the major character. Thus, Cassius's lieutenant, Titinius, kills himself before Cassius does. And Portia, who is Brutus's wife, commits suicide before he does. In this particular and important matter, Shakespeare recognized that the Romans had a code of values that was utterly opposed to that of Christianity, and he strove to be accurate to it. And the association between Rome and the permissibility of suicide was obviously very strong in his mind because it occurs in casual ways in other plays. Macbeth, at the end of his play, says, "Why should I play the Roman fool and fall upon my sword? I'm going to fight, and they're tough." It's just a casual reference to Rome. Rome isn't important, but the Roman fool is the way to describe a person who commits suicide. The association is so strong. Now, the permissibility of suicide is an index to a larger act of historical fidelity going on in Julius Caesar. Shakespeare has systematically removed his customary web of Christian references. I've been pointing out a lot of Christian things in the plays of Shakespeare, in the comedies, in the tragedies, in the histories, rather, comedies and histories. I'm only getting into the tragedies. Elizabethan civilization was drenched in Christian practices and customs. I've not been trying to say that Shakespeare is preaching Christianity. He doesn't need to preach Christianity. That's the culture around him. That's the culture of his audience. And people would make Christian references as casually as they would breathe air. It was just part of natural life for them. And in tragedy, it is natural for people to begin to speculate about the theological, the metaphysical meaning of the sufferings and disasters that take place. But not in the Roman tragedies. In Julius Caesar, there are gods. There are forces larger than men. There is a terrific storm the night before Caesar is assassinated. And there is the ghost of Caesar that later appears to Brutus. But the play lacks the insistent questioning about the meaning of these things in any true metaphysical sense. Hamlet gives us glimpses of life beyond the grave, and Hamlet pursues those glimpses, asks questions, thinks about those things. Macbeth gives us a hero who believes he is destined to eternal damnation, that he will go to hell when he dies. He thinks on that. He talks about it. But in this play, the characters do not follow up that possibility, that line of inquiry. The storm, for example, that I just mentioned, the storm has human impact. Cassius is elated by it. He opens his clothing and exposes his chest to the storm. He feels exhilarated by it. Casca is terrified by it, the lightning bolts and the other manifestations. Calpurnia, the wife of Caesar, sees some possible connections between the storm. When beggars die, there are no comets seen. The heavens themselves blaze forth the death of princes. But that's all she says. It doesn't go on to raise any question about fatedness or free will or anything else. It just is there as an observation. There must be some connection. I don't know what it is. And when the ghost appears, we do not begin to ask questions about the nature of the afterlife or whether the ghost is speaking truly, as we do in Hamlet. The ghost appears to Brutus in his tent and says, "I will see you at Philippi." And Brutus says, "Very well, you will see me at Philippi." And that's it. I'll come back to that later, but that's all the dialogue that is exchanged. Contrast that with the way Hamlet thinks about the ghost. In other words, the world has some divine resonance. The earthly events have some divine resonance. They are connected somehow to storms and ghosts and bigger things. But you can't translate that resonance into any specific meaning. And the characters don't try. Reality is political. It's ethical. It's psychological. Reality is not pursued into its possible theological or metaphysical areas. Brutus and Cassius speak of their philosophy several times, but what they mean by their philosophy is ethics, Stoicism or Epicureanism, what we would call philosophy of life, how you cope. not statements about the origin and destiny of the universe or the fundamental nature of humankind. When Caesar orders a sacrifice and the beast sacrificed proves to lack a heart, the interpretation of that omen is entirely left up to human beings. Caesar says this shows that Caesar would be utterly without courage if he didn't go forth. Calpurnius takes it as a terrible omen. You mustn't go forth. But there is no revealed supernatural world. Shakespeare, I'm saying, then, is making a deliberate historical experiment. There is the matter of Rome. There is this tremendously rich historical, ethical, psychological, political area which we can explore. Let us concentrate on that laboratory, and not follow it outside the walls. Let us make it a laboratorily pure experiment and not involve the gods directly. Now, I could rephrase this more sharply if, instead of talking of the general matter of Rome, I spoke specifically of Shakespeare's source, the particular book he used, a book by Plutarch called, in its English translation, The Lives of the Noble Grecians and Romans. Plutarch was one of the great classical historians. He was a Greek who lived toward the end of the first century A.D., beginning of the second. He wrote in Greek. Shakespeare used the English translation produced by an older contemporary called Sir Thomas North. Came out in 1579, when Shakespeare was 15 years old. North's Plutarch is probably the greatest book that Shakespeare pillaged, that Shakespeare really made a lot of use out of. Yes, he used a bit of Homer, and he used a bit of Chaucer in Troilus and Cressida and so forth. But Plutarch is a major source where he takes whole stories, the plots of whole plays, and used him three or four times, over and over again. Most of Shakespeare's major sources are minor authors. Holinshed, the historian, whom he relies upon for his 10 history plays. A dreadfully dreary writer. Nobody reads Holinshed except people who are interested in Shakespeare. You don't read Holinshed for his own sake. But Plutarch's Lives is a distinguished piece of historical writing, well worth reading, even if Shakespeare had never based a play on it. It is a distinguished work on human nature. And Shakespeare obviously respected Plutarch and used him with scrupulous care. I don't mean he didn't change details. Of course he will, to dramatize for theatrical purposes. But he's creating a Plutarchan world, working within Plutarch's frame of reference, not loading Christianity and other revelations on top of Plutarch. Moreover, Plutarch's conception of history is indeed one very useful to a tragic playwright. Plutarch saw history as biography, as the lives of great men. And of course you can put the life of a great man into a play instead of a block of history. It translates much more easily into dramatic form. The lives are very strong narratives that invite drama. Moreover, Plutarch wrote a kind of analytic biography. That is, he doesn't just give you the life. He gives you two lives, a pair, a noble Greek and a noble Roman, selected so that there is likeness and difference. And each unit ends with a formal